Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Jewel Ornament of Liberation, Chapters 18 and 19, The Aspects of the Five Paths and the Levels of the Path by Eric Weinberg. The Bodhisattva path can be mapped as the five levels of awakening. This talk describes the paths of accumulation, juncture, seeing, meditation, and no more learning, and the levels of spiritual development that come with all five. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good to see you all. So chapter 18 is the aspects of the five paths, and chapter 19, the levels of the path. There's a lot of material here since it's a summary of literally everything that we've done so far, which is that much. And so what I want to do is I want to start and tell you there is one big idea here. And that big idea is that it's possible for each of us. In fact, it's in a sense our birthright, if you will, to become Buddhas. The subtext of that is, on the one hand, you would say, well, that's great. Why don't I just get a blessing and become a Buddha, and then that'll happen? Well, apparently it can't work that way. Even Buddhas, fully enlightened Buddhas, can't make it work that way. What has to happen is we each have to have each of our minds, our mind streams, no matter how many lifetimes they may have under their belt, have to experience this directly. It turns out that we can't just understand it and get it. We can't just read about it and so on. It has to be our direct experience. Something like reading about Chicago isn't like actually going there and feeling how cold Lake Michigan is and feeling how cutting the winter wind is. You can read all about it, but until you feel it, you just don't know it directly for yourself. Likewise, when you know it directly for yourself, even a Buddha could come and say, nope, you got that wrong. And you could say, no, I got it right. I've been there. This is my experience. So the importance of this book in general, and these two chapters in particular, is that it lays out this process. And it kind of, there's good news and bad news. The good news is it's guaranteed to work. The bad news is there are no shortcuts. And so what Gyanpopa does here is he lays out each of the paths. Now, how this is useful for me in particular is I actually like doing Dharma practice, so I'm lucky in that way. And I like the prayers. I like doing them in English because I'm a native English speaker and I understand English words. And the translations anymore are pretty good. And what I see is this incredible, brilliant structure to these prayers and these practices that we've been given. They include these paths and these levels right within them that Gyanpopa says we have to engage in order to achieve Buddhahood. So what's going on the whole time is that step by step, stage by stage, day on the cushion after day on the cushion, our minds are being trained and our minds are starting, the old bad habits are starting to loosen up so that we can see things as they actually are. And seeing things as they actually are is what Buddhahood is. It's that simple. Now, you may think that you see things the way they actually are, but it turns out that the way we see things is obviously conditioned a lot by our habits. By doing the practices, while there are no shortcuts, they actually do take us through these five paths and these levels that sometimes you see called bhumis. And those prayers and practices have been written to help us retrain our minds and start to loosen up these habits. It's a little bit like understanding that the room you're in right now has a wide spectrum of light, but you only see a narrow part of it. You don't see the ultraviolet, you don't see the infrared, and so on. But it's there. So Buddhahood is seeing things as they are, which means that our preferences have been purified. That's what's being purified. Our habits are being purified. Our attachments are no more, in a sense, to preferring one thing to another. Now, how do we do it? Well, according to Gampopa, first we start with the path of accumulation. And the path of accumulation is just beginning to add a lot of virtuous activity to our life, whatever we can think of. Helping others, making offerings to others. You know, when you see somebody hungry, feeding them. When you see somebody sick, rather than giving them a lot of advice, good, bad, or indifferent, comforting them, and so forth. So as we accumulate what in the jargon is called merit, but I don't really like that word. What we're really accumulating is a sense of connection and empathy and sympathetic joy in the good fortune of others when we see it and so forth. We're beginning to loosen this clingy feeling that we have about my ideas and my preferences and the things I want to avoid, so that we can open up to what's around us and see it in a way that's not conditioned by the mental habits that we usually live with and think of as just normal and think of, oh, that's the way it is. It's pretty easy to see that what we think of as the way it is isn't the way it is. It's easy to see this. Think about your preferences in music. I can tell you, in my case, a lot of people think opera is the best music that there is. I don't like opera. It's weird. Why don't I like it? Well, there's something about it that annoys me. And there are a number of things that annoy me. Well, why do they annoy me? Well, it's because I have some idea of what I like and what I don't like, and I have some story I tell myself about it. As I start to open up my life, you know, some of this virtuous activity might be, for instance, rather than telling my mother, who loves opera, that, you know, I don't like it, and, you know, it's no good, making sure she has tickets to see it. Even now under COVID, you know, there are broadcasts you can get tickets for so that she can see and listen to the opera, even though it's not my thing. Well, that kind of loosens up my own prejudices, and it helps me drop my own story about all of that. which in turn begins to quiet my mind. One of the classical prayers that we use in Buddhism to begin this accumulation is to pray the refuge prayer. And when we do these talks, we begin with the refuge prayer for a whole lot of reasons. One is to invite the blessings of all the Buddhas, but another is to train our own minds in this direction of accumulating virtue so that we can accomplish the next of the two paths, which is the path of juncture, where the practice of meditation becomes like the main activity. So let's start with refuge prayer. I'll say it three times in some fashion or another. There are a lot of different translations and stuff. I'll say it in English so that everybody can understand what it is. And the first time, imagine that the external world, everything that you see outside of yourself is encompassed by the blessing of this prayer and, in a sense, the reality of it. And the second time through, imagine that your own feelings and thoughts and stories about life are also blessed and infused with the truth of this prayer. And the third time, just let it resonate through the openness of your awareness itself. In the Buddha, the teacher, the Dharma, his teaching, and the community of all that practice the teaching, we take refuge until the heart of enlightenment is reached. Through generosity, ethics, patience, joyful diligence, meditation, and wisdom, we vow to bring all beings without exception to this state of enlightenment. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the community, we take refuge until enlightenment. Upon reaching enlightenment, we vow to bring all beings to that state beyond suffering. That is enlightenment. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, we take refuge until enlightenment. By accomplishing this enlightenment, we vow to bring all beings without exception to that state. Thank you. So the path of accumulation includes this this big-minded aspiration. And then, you know, as we begin to actually engender that in a consistent way, maybe many times during the day, we feel motivated, deeply motivated to enter the path for real. We really want to see the true nature of things, because if we don't really see the true nature of things, including ourselves, how in the world will we actually be able to bring all of this about that we're talking about? And so we make aspirations. We aspire towards that. In meditation, you know, we start every meditation without exception with looking at our motivation. And of course, there's a self that wants to meditate, that wants to pass beyond suffering, that wants to grow and be a benefit, of course. But we take a moment and realize that every living thing wants exactly the same things. So we make the aspiration that our practice would in some way bless everyone, all living beings, to support them and help them on this path. And that's the aspiration. Right at that point, you know, it's according to Trungpa Rinpoche, the path in a sense is a little bit artificial. It's a little bit fictitious because we're not there yet. We don't really know what we're asking for. We still only have the map of the territory in a sense, not the territory itself. So, and we don't reach that sense of reality until the third stage of the path, which is called the path of insight. But he says, and he makes this point, I felt this was really important. We're on the path of junction. It's no longer just trying to accumulate good actions, but we're concentrating on meditation, so that we can actually directly realize and experience these things that we aspire towards. So while our meditation isn't the real experience yet, by forming this aspiration and this altruistic motivation, and then step by step practicing properly, we come closer. He says it's very useful because it prepares us for the real experience. That's really interesting. The real experience is something that can, I've heard from beings who have some realization that it can be pretty overwhelming. So we need to strengthen ourselves. We need to train. We need to drill and practice to know how to handle it. So this path of junction is called the path of junction for this reason, that it gets us ready to come into connection with reality. He said, we're going to have all sorts of experiences. Sometimes they're pleasant and stable and clear. We may see a lot of things. We may see light, we may see colors, we may see Buddhas and Yidams and all that kind of stuff. That can happen. We can also have experiences that are really unpleasant. We can feel really uptight when we're practicing. We can feel really unhappy. We can feel really unclear and difficult. And we can hear and see a lot of things that we don't like. He says we may even see ghosts. And then he says, these are all just experiences that may occur in meditation. Good or bad, it doesn't matter. All this is just a manifestation of our own mind. It's really important to regard all of these things as dreamlike rather than as some kind of important sign at this stage, because if it's what we prefer, the kind of experience we prefer, we can get proud, and we can, our ego can get a little bit out of bounds. You know, I know you've no doubt run into people who kind of strut their stuff. Well, that's a big obstacle. Think about it. What does that do? That just reifies, that just builds stronger this sense of self-separateness. This is my experience. I have something to offer, you know, blah, 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 because you don't have that experience and you should. Or it can do the opposite. If it's a really difficult experience, you can get depressed. Think my meditation's not going right. Think it's not a good meditation. All of that kind of thing. Well, that's an obstacle too. The thing that connects those two obstacles is it's all about me. It's I, me, mine. And the thing about meditation when it's properly done is that no matter what comes up, we just drop the thought and return to the object of our meditation. That's why meditation on the breath is so powerful. The breath is always there with us. It's subtle enough to not be a distraction itself, and it's present and strong enough to actually be a thing. Ultimately, we can even drop the breath and meditate on awareness itself, the awareness within which all these experiences, thoughts, feelings, and so on arise. And then when they arise, you realize that your consciousness has gone to the bird flying through the sky, so to speak, instead of just remaining with the sky itself. And you appreciate the bird or the cloud or whatever is there in the sky. And then you just, with gratitude for having seen it, let it go. Likewise, we let go of the stories we tell ourselves about all those, because within those stories that we're telling ourselves, our habits arise. And of course, the habits get solidified into who we think we are, and on you go down the road to making your false sense of self a little stronger. And that's the very obstacle, the root obstacle that all these practices are starting to drip to help melt away. It's not that enlightenment isn't already there for you. You've already got it. The problem is it's obscured. And so it's with these practices and with this training that we begin to let go. We let go of our attachments to the things that are barriers between us and our heart's desire. It's really pretty funny when you think about it. It's there all the time. And yet we hold on, we cling so tight to this false identity, which is itself the thing that keeps us from what this self wants. So anyway, this path of juncture is a path of getting used to, a path of familiarization with this dynamic and learning how to play with it really effectively. All the practices do that. He said that the sign of real understanding or realization are that our mind becomes more peaceful, more in control, that our pride diminishes, and that the wish to help others increases. The signs of successful meditation are that our negativities decrease to a great degree. As said, the purpose of the meditation is not to have all sorts of experiences, visions, sounds, and the like. The point is to achieve success in getting rid of our negativity and the mind becoming more clear, having less and less pride, less anger, and less involvement with negative appearances in the mind. These are the real signs of good meditation, according to Trungpa Rinpoche. So, we practice this meditation out of aspiration, out of an idea of our goal in terms of the qualities of purity, and that negativities will be reduced. When this begins to happen, and it will happen, I mean, it's been going on for 2,600 years. It works. So when this starts to happen, you know, our faith in the practice and our devotion to the practice begin to increase. In other words, we gain some power, some energy. And that means that we can find the strength to go on to the path of insight. And it does require strength. So he says, when we've practiced with great inspiration, faith, and diligence, then the path will bring a real result, a real sign of success, which is actually insight into the truth. The truth is always there, but it's temporarily obscured by impurities. What is mistaken is distorted by mistakes. What is pure is veiled by illusion. The truth is not something that was made up by the Buddha or something that can be given to us by the three jewels. Therefore, what we need to do is to get rid of our illusion, get rid of the mistake. Our mind is made about the nature of things. Then the truth will be seen. So, there's this story that I got, and I want to describe this because it's a real story, and it's about Gampopa and the first Karmapa, who was Gampopa's main student. And this is a story of how the Karmapa kind of went through this path that we're talking about here. I thought that if you could hear this story, you'd probably get it on another level than just the concepts of step-by-step pathway presentation might give you. So in service to this big idea that we can all achieve enlightenment on this path, here's the story of Gampopa's instructions to the first Karmapa. Among the many oral instructions that the first Karmapa received from Gampopa was the Mahamudra view that thoughts need not be artificially amputated during meditation. Gampopa said, "This co-emergent unification of ours is one of our key oral instructions. Whatever thought occurs in your conscious mind, no matter how much you may want it or not want it, you simply observe that thought is mind. Likewise, whatever appears is seen as mind. In this way, we take thoughts and appearances onto the path. Thoughts are not the problem. It's our discursive attachment to those thoughts that creates obstacles." Discursive attachment is like the stories we tell ourselves about what we experience. So the story we tell ourselves gets in the way of the direct experience. After Karmapa had practiced in retreat for some time, he felt he had a genuine experience of bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. So he told Gampopa about it. The teacher replied, "Ah, you look directly at it. That's good. Now tell me, where did the root of those experiences come from?" Dusum Kempa, the first Karmapa, couldn't answer that. So Gampopa said, "Well then, you need to continue to meditate just like that. Meditate often, but only for short sessions. Keep that up. And whatever else you do, make consciousness your servant." So Karmapa continued alternating like this, meditating in retreat, then discussing it with Gampopa. One night, he dreamt that a monk appeared and explained a new dharma to him that he had not heard before. The dream was very lucid, so he hurriedly reported it to his guru. Gampopa asked him, "Did you like the dream?" Karmapa said, "Yes, indeed, he liked it a lot." Gampopa flew into a rage and rebuked his student. "Listen, you are going to have all sorts of marvels happening when you meditate, but you have to understand they are all just illusory appearances. Treat them as illusory appearances, and they will turn into the path. But if you hold those appearances to be real entities, they will remain obstacles. So, whatever comes up in your mind, do not cling to any of it as good and do not reject any of it as bad. Understand all of it to be non-dual. Whenever a thought arises, don't let it spawn a discursive stream of analysis. No, it simply is conditioned mind arising from latent karma, and let it go." I want to emphasize one thing. So when we meditate, what we're practicing really is when we notice a thought, we look directly at it, let it go, and return to our breath or our bare awareness or an object we're looking at. And so on. If it's a really captivating thing like a dream or the idea or the experience that Buddha had come to my meditation room and visited me and given me a teaching, and I was busy, you know, thinking about how that fit into everything that I ever learned and how wonderful that is and how blessed I had become and so on, story after story about this experience. What Gampopa is saying here is drop the story, just drop it. All of that is arising out of the way your mind is programmed to handle such experiences. So that's the obstacle itself. If you drop it and treat it as a dream, it's not like it's not a part of your mind stream now. It'll become part of the path, but it won't become an obstacle. So that's an important instruction. So Karmapa continued this sequence of retreats and interviews. And one day he came down and reported, "The awareness I have developed is usually clear during the day, but at night there's still a distraction." Gampopa answered, "Yes, you still have a fault. You have the fault that when the awareness is clear, you like it, and when it's not clear, you don't. That's not the right approach. Put your Rigpa in empty clarity as usual, and then whatever arises, know it as non-dual. During the day, luminosity will mix with appearances, and at night, luminosity will mix with dreams. No matter what arises, remain in equanimity." What equanimity means is drop your preferences. So if you prefer the clarity of daytime. So in this case, drop it. Drop the preference. Okay, clarity's there. Let go and just return to awareness. Or at nighttime when things are unclear and dreams are interrupting your bare awareness, okay. Lack of clarity is there. Obscuration is there. Let it go and return to the bare awareness. Obviously, awareness is always there. If it wasn't, you wouldn't be aware of it. So it's just the shift gets more and more subtle. Equanimity is when we let go of our preferences for one thing or another. And it's important training. So he continues, when you are among crowds, regulate your speech and meditate. Whatever you are doing, be mindful of the stillness of your awareness in the midst of the movements of samsara. So Karmapa continued on with his practice and eventually was able to report progress to Gampopa. He said, finally, my abiding has lessened. When I entrusted everything to pure awareness, any discursive thought that arose also went into the state of pure awareness. There are a lot of prayers, you may notice this along the way, where it talks about thoughts arising like a wave and then falling and dissolving back into their own face. In other words, a wave arising and then falling back into the ocean. This is what Gampopa is recommending as the way we regard thoughts. They come up like a wave. It's still all ocean. And then if we let them go, we don't freeze them by surrounding them with a lot of our ideas, our habits, our preferences, and so forth. If we just let them go, they fall back in to this ocean of awareness. That's how we, in a very direct way, take each thought that arises, each experience, and bring it to the path without adding a lot of chatter or a lot of story to it. He went on, Karmapa went on, as each discursive thought arose, the experience was deepened by it. Then, when I let awareness go free as well, an experience of luminous emptiness remained as unfabricated equanimity. Even in post-meditation, the result was that nothing arising in the six senses was reified or, was built up as inherently existing. Everything was present as mind itself. When Gampopa heard this, he replied, well, that's it. So, what's clear is this is a process, even for somebody with as much talent and training as Karmapa. But it depended on step-by-step honesty about how things are and working with somebody like, we may not meet somebody like Gampopa, but there's blessing. There's always somebody around who's maybe one step ahead on the path that can help us recognize when we're beginning to cling to an experience as a realization when it's not realization yet. Help us let it go and help us return to what we were doing that got us that far with some more enthusiasm and some appreciation for the progress that has happened already. So we depend on one another a lot. That's what being with a group of practitioners is all about. That's really the way that we can support each other a lot. We're lucky in our community to have a number of meditation instructors that can be helpful. Certainly Lama Kathy, Lama Tom, and Lama Adam, and everybody's available to help. While none of us are at the level of Gampopa, we're still in a position, I think, to help. So that's where this path of insight is. The path of insight is this direct realization that all thoughts, all experiences arise as mind, in the sense, if they weren't there, where else would they be? And if we let them go, they fall back into the space of mind and deepen it. I love that part of the story where he said, and it became deeper. It's amazing to me, actually. And then the final stage was, of course, to let go of his, even the most subtle concept, this concept of awareness itself. As you go along the meditation path, the important thing about that is that whatever we identify as other, even our own awareness, you know, who's aware of awareness? Who's that? Who's aware of you on my Zoom screen? Who's that? And so eventually, if you keep inquiring, this is the path of insight, this path of inquiry and analysis married with the power of meditation, of letting go. Ultimately, we come to a space where even awareness isn't a separate thing. Not much more, there's nothing more I can say about that except that try it on the cushion. Just look at your own mind and see who's aware of that. And then see who's aware of that. And so forth. You'll have a certain experience, and that is what the first Karmapa Dusan Kempa, that experience was what he was progressively sharing with his teacher Gampopa. And as he shared it, they were able to find the next level and the next level to open up so that Dusan Kempa could have this experience of realization directly for himself. So once that has happened, you know, you come to a place of what they call irreversibility. It's kind of like, yeah, okay, I've been to Chicago. Even if Buddha himself came and told me that Chicago was one way and I had definitely seen that it was something else, he couldn't convince me because I saw it for myself, right? It's tricky that way. There's all those old analogies of, you know, being in a slightly darkened room where there's a rope coiled in the corner and you notice it out of the corner of your eye and you get startled because you think there's a snake there. Well, it's not a snake, it's a rope, right? We know that ahead of time from the story. But you don't know it viscerally, personally, until somebody turns the light on. And then when the light goes on, you can see that it's not a snake, it's a rope. This is the same kind of process. So this path that takes us from accumulation to juncture, which is developing a meditation practice, to insight, which is marrying that practice with direct inquiry into the way things are, is the way that we flip the light switch. Okay. Now, the fourth path is the path of cultivation. Because we have strong habits, and they don't just disappear because we had some insight, they don't disappear. And cultivation is a way of working with our minds to become very familiar with this mechanism that we're involved in. With whatever practice you choose, you know, be it a yidam practice, a shamatha, vipassana, union of shamatha and vipassana, whatever practice it is will help you cultivate this. And as you cultivate it more and more, you become very familiar with the way your mind works. And you get better at playing the game that it's got you in, all right? And once you get the game, once you can identify, to put in football terms, not all of you are football people, I know, but, you know, a good defensive coordinator is going to be able to read the offense, know the game, and do the right thing in order to accomplish whatever aspiration or goal they might have, and vice versa. You know, a good offensive coordinator will be able to read the defense and try to work with that. We can play with our own minds in that way. Once we have the strength and we have the tools, we need the tools to use, and then we need the strength to use them. And as we do that, we realize this thing that in Buddhism they tell you, we tell us, they tell you, whatever, that everything's an illusion. It's all has to do with this, everything is arising from causes and conditions. You change the causes and conditions and something else will arise. And you can begin to skillfully work with that. So in the path of cultivation, as we begin to skillfully work with this in everything we do, we enter what is in the text, and you've seen skillful means. We begin to be skillful about what we're doing. And a lot of this has to do with the ability to get out of our own way, you know? Drop the habits, take strength to do that. Drop the preferences, take strength to do that. And when you do, I know you've all experienced this before, in whatever line of work you may be in, we get out of our own way, and like insight starts to pop up naturally. We get intuitions, we get things happening in our minds that are like, you know, wow, a brilliant solution that I just didn't know could be there that way before. And so automatically we start losing this sense of ignorance. We start losing this sense of anger at things not being the way we want them to be. We start losing the desire to have our way, because now we're working with the mind and we're dropping that stuff, and there's a good result. There's more light there than we thought was there. And that's the path of cultivation. I like to think of it as playful. The text says that this is where we begin to really see the Four Noble Truths, and in particular, the Eightfold Path. So that's more serious. The fifth path is the path of accomplishment. And Trungpa Rinpoche says, in Sanskrit, Buddha is Tathagata. In Tibetan, it's Dashen Shegpa. What those words mean is gone to thatness. He says it's not like going to a foreign place or something new that we fabricate. It's plainly simply seeing what is there, seeing the truth as it is, the real nature of things. It is the thatness that is there, the isness. So, he said another synonym for Buddha is Sugata in Sanskrit. In Tibetan, it would be Dewa Shegpa, which means gone to bliss or gone to happiness. So that's the thing. What's there, what's actually there, the truth of things, is not just emptiness. It's empty of our habitual reactions. It's empty of our preferences. But at the same time, because those things have been cleared up and we're not reactive, that's the big deal. Not reactive. This thing we call emptiness is actually the very expression of great happiness and bliss. So that's the five paths, the way Gyanpopo lays them out for us. So this idea that something from the outside will be given, it's not true. The problem is just the distortion that we put on what's here now. So the meditation for that, this isn't in the book, but in the spirit of Buddha being Tathagata, or a sense of thatness, this is really simple. So it does require a little strength. So I would recommend having, a practice just to a shamatha practice to bring your mind to a state, a habit of being in a state of calm abiding. And then when you walk around all day, this is a thing. Whatever happens, whoever you see, obviously you'll react to it. You'll like it, you won't like it, you'll be neutral to it. Drop that reaction. Just drop it and change your thought to, I am that. So I'm looking at you on this Zoom screen, and where I do this practice, I just look and I say, I am that. Because this sense of emptiness is really what is pointing to is a sense of being empty of the illusion of self and other. It's seeing directly that everything's interdependent. It's not that we don't exist exactly, it's just that we don't exist as separate entities. We exist as part of this great mandala of reality that is connected by the energy of what I'll just call love. So when we drop this illusion of self and other, we begin to get a glimpse now and then of this web of interdependence and connection, and it changes everything in your life, changes it all, changes the relationship we have to ourselves, changes the relationship we have to everything that's alive, this is part of the insight that His Holiness Dalai Lama, His Holiness Karmapa, are sharing with the world in their raising, what let's call it, environmental consciousness. What they're raising is this powerful, powerful sense that we're all connected to each other and to everything that appears and exists, and everything is connected to us. So, you know, having the care and the wisdom of love for what we see, and skillful means in order to know how to work with it, compassion to know how to work with it, is an important, you know, jewel in the teaching that these great people, these great teachers are offering us right now. It's a direct pointing out what our own experience on the path is and can be and actually will be. So with that idea, it's 12:30 and I have to bring this talk to a close. But before we do that, let's gather together all this virtue that we've accumulated and dedicated. So think about this extraordinary wonder that you are part of the Buddha's mandala, and the Buddha is part of your mandala along with everybody else. Truly, it's a moment of realizing I am that. And with that love that you've accumulated, and that you feel, offer it to all that you're connected to, without exception. Just dropping preferences and habits and liking or not liking this or that. Share it with everybody. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.